Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to start off with, well, let me tell you, I think I know about all these things, and then there's something new that I didn't know about. Just learned that there is a thing, which I do not have one of, called baking steel.
There you go.
And the inventor of this cooking utensil actually wrote a book about it called Baking with Steel. And if you get that book, Langsdon will tell you all about it.
The interesting thing is it was just kind of like a freaky thing. His family just happens to own a business that makes metal sheets, steel sheets.
Yeah.
But they never made them for this market before, but now they did. Now right after that, we're clearing stuff cooking with steel some more. So hang around and find out what we mean by that. And, of course, there's some usual fascinating stuff at the end of the program. So shall we get underway today with?
Yes, with Andrus Langsdon's Baking with Steel. I guess I must have been under a rock somewhere because I didn't know anything about this baking with steel.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking to its inventor, Andrus Langsdon. And Andrus, I'm going to quote one of my most favorite people, J. Kenzie Lopez Alt, and did the introduction to your book. And it really caught my attention where he wrote, every decade or two, a revolutionary idea turns into a revolutionary product that actually does change the way we make our food. And he's referring to your invention of the baking with steel, and which is a piece of equipment, right?
Correct.
Now, you have the perfect background for this. I mean, you were familiar with working in kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
You worked with Todd English, and you are from Boston, and you developed a great sense of how to make pizzas.
And, yes.
And then your family was in the steel business and invited you to come back and work with the family in the family business, and you did. And whammo, you came up with this idea.
Boom. Yeah, totally. So what happened was, I worked with Todd, goes back many years. I don't want to date myself, but it goes back several years. I worked in the restaurants, and I studied restaurant management and culinary arts and always thought I'd be working in restaurants my entire life. Mm-hmm. I got a little burnt out in my early 30s and decided to take a little break. My dad was looking for help, and a business I've worked with my entire life. He's a steel manufacturer. He produces products made out of steel for a product called a flip pad, more specifically, but he works for companies like Caterpillar,
yes,
John Deere, the big guys, if you will.
Yeah.
So I've been doing that for the last 15 or so years. I was reading some food science back in 2011. Mirvold, correct.
Yeah, we're interviewing him coming up about his modernist bread book. I guess that fits right in here, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, that's right. So I was reading about that and the launch of that book originally in 2011, and it gave me the idea. He said to Google your local steel shop for steel, and just like hit me like a sledgehammer over the head. And so I literally grabbed some steel. I ran out to my plant and I grabbed some steel, and I made pizza that weekend, and I was blown by the crispy bottom. I don't know if anybody out there, any of the listeners, make pizza at home. It's a struggle to really good pizza at home and make it crispy on the bottom.
Yeah, because you just can't get the temp, right?
Yeah, you just can't get it.
But there's more to it, though. I mean, in this book, you explained about it's an energy exchange.
Right. So what's happening, the steel conducts energy well, right?
Yes.
But it's also storing energy. It's storing about 18 times the energy of stone.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Which is amazing. And how does that translate into food? Well, if we have two ovens, one with a steel and one with a stone, and we blast those ovens to 500 degrees, well, we can't cheat physics, right? Each one of those is going to hit 500 degrees. But when we open that oven up, we lose heat.
Yeah.
And we put our dough on, we lose more heat. Well, the steel does not lose as much heat and it rebounds that much faster. So we're actually able to cook pizzas in like 3 or 4 minutes in a home oven at 500 degrees just because of the way that heat transfers so fast.
Now, you'd like to get it even hotter than that, though, right? I mean, the real crispy of pizza ovens, they say, get to like 800 degrees.
Right. They do. They get, and that's why the Neapolitan styles of getting it done in 90 seconds or so. But in a home environment, yeah, I could blast the broiler, get that steel a little bit hotter. We could do it in like 2.5-3 minutes. I did one live on Facebook last week or on Instagram in about 2.5 minutes. Just because that heat's transferring so fast into that steel. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, that's it. I have a burnout oven for lost wax casting, and it tiddles along at 900.
Oh, wow. What kind of oven is that?
It's too small to do pizza. It's a burnout oven.
Okay.
Pattern and yeah, and fumes are something fierce from that.
Oh, I bet. It's incredible. Yeah.
No, so I get worried about, you keep cautioning everybody, first of all, because it's heavy and how to lift it. But I'm used to cooking with cast iron pots.
Right. And to be honest, like the weight in the beginning, when I first launched this I did a Kickstarter project in September of 2012. And I was, the pizza steel, the baking steel is literally 15 pounds, the original.
Oh, wow.
And so I was really, really nervous about that because it was by far the heaviest piece of steel or heaviest piece of kitchen equipment out there. And I tried to make it lighter, but to be honest, the weight is what makes it work so well.
Yeah.
Well, the thickness, right?
Correct. That mass. In fact, we make thicker ones. We make half-inch versions, which are literally 30 pounds.
What do you need those for?
Well, you know, the science is the bigger the mass, the more energy it stores.
Yeah.
So it's going to cook pizzas and rebound even faster in between. Do I think it's necessary to go that thick? I think 3/8 is plenty. Even 1/4 inch is plenty of horsepower.
It's really funny. My cousin Richard, who is not a culinary genius by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
He lives in Australia. He has a small... I guess you call it a farm.
Yeah.
He grows avocados and
that's amazing.
All
yeah.
kinds of things like that. But
Richard's amazing.
But he has a cooking fireplace outside.
Oh, cool.
And what's the
That's right.
The surface,
I forgot about
the surface
that.
Is cast iron.
Oh, interesting, right.
And
I thought it was steel.
And pretty thick cast iron at that. Well, the difference between iron and steel is very, very minor when it comes to
Yeah, it's very minor. It's not. It's not a lot.
I mean, it's like one. No, you. If you're alloying it, you're adding maybe 1 or 2% of something else.
Yeah, it's very minimal, right? It's a different process to make them. Basically, you can kind of pour your shape,
right.
versus fabricate. But some things are just easier to pour, like a cast iron pan, basically.
Yeah.
If you fabricate that, that would be a lot of welding.
Now, it's surprising in a way that you didn't include some copper or something like that in here. There's a very famous maker of pots and pans based here in the Pittsburgh area called Allclad.
Oh, yes. Know them well.
And their skill base was from creating metal sandwiches, which they used for industrial applications, but all including some copper, which meant that they heated up a whole lot faster.
Yeah, their favorite was the copper clad.
Yeah, I think our friend Kenji actually made a copper steel, a baking steel out of copper. He had someone make it for him. But the cost is exorbitant.
Right.
Oh.
And it doesn't really make up in any kind of performance.
I see.
Right? So we find I've used stainless steel, I've used different kinds of steel, but we find this low carbon steel is just the ultimate for making pizza and breads. And that what we also learned is that the pizzas and breads are great. What happens if you sear a steak on there? Well, you have this amazing searing plate now as well. You can put it on our grill. You can put it on our stovetop. So we actually started making a griddle version. So around the perimeter of the steel, we've carved out some metal and turned it into a griddle on one side and a baking steel on the other side.
Yeah, I thought that was a great idea.
It's brilliant, and it's like my favorite product because now you can do anything from, pancakes to breakfasts. you can be like an IHOP chef at home, which is really fun.
Yeah.
To, you know, smash burgers and we could even do ice cream on these things.
Yeah, tell us.
Hold on a minute. Let me get my piece in edgeways first.
We're also curious about this. No.
It's interesting. I wondered if Chef had heard of Pittsburgh style as a way of cooking steak, otherwise known as black and blue.
Oh yeah, I've heard that. Take me through that process.
And what used to happen is the guys would take a piece of steak with them to the mill. And then when it was time to eat, they would throw it on the, you know, some part of the steel making process that was
so hot.
It was good and hot, so it would cook on the outside black, and then the blue is just simply a corruption of the French bleu, which
trust the
French to call something blue when it's really red.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah, so using that same principle, like we put our griddle on, we blast our heat to like 400, 500 degrees. It takes about 10 minutes to get up the temperature, right? And then you basically just toss your steak on there, season with like a little bit of salt and pepper, but you get this amazing crust. You get an amazing sear on your steaks. And you sear for like 3 minutes on each side, and boom, let it rest, cut it open, and man, it's so good.
Yeah, that's the way the Argentinians cook their beef, right?
Yeah, totally, right. And cooking with fire.
In fact, there's one here called Gaucho
Perea. Yeah.
Gaucho Perea, which that's exactly what they do.
Oh, they do that.
And it's really, it's really, do that, it's really
have
delicious.
Have you been to that spot?
We go all the time.
When we're really hungry, we go there.
Now, you run us through all the qualities of these cooking utensils or equipment.
Yeah, So we're a manufacturing company first, and my brother handles all the manufacturing, and we're, you know, what we call an ISO registered company, meaning we speak a quality that is international, with international firms, so we have to meet certain criteria for all of our processes. So, yeah, and that's, selfishly, it's great because we know at the end of the day we're producing good product, and if we, you know, because each step has its own check, if you will. And that's really important. And we're proudly made in the USA, which we're really happy with that.
Yeah, that's great.
But you just said you had some new... Oh, no, the Germans are stealing your idea.
There's some copycats out there. But, you know, that's like, if you look at any product, there's more than one, right? There's Coca-Cola and there's Pepsi. There's McDonald's, there's Burger King, right? There's more than one of everything. The idea is to separate yourself and focus on what you do well. In our case, you know, we do a lot of, like, we call micro-branding, where we have our own test kitchen now, and once a week we teach pizza classes. So we teach folks how to make some of the best pizza they've ever had.
Yeah, well, you really give details on the ferments, how long to ferment.
Yeah,
I mean,
totally.
That's, I know, I'm not a pizza nerd in that way, but I could tell you.
You're not a nerd, pizza nerd?
No, I mean, I could tell you that the expert pizza makers that I've had, there's a big difference between what you get in pizza, you know.
There's all the difference in the world. So we've literally talked to, like, the best pizza makers in the country, and, you know, including, you know, like Kenji and Tony Gemignotti and Chris Bianco and what all these guys do. They all do a long ferment.
Yeah.
And the one test I always say in our pizza class, because we guide you through the process of the 3-day process in like 2 hours, so we kind of staged some of these things.
Yes.
But if you mix your flour, salt, water, and yeast together, right, and you knead it for a couple of minutes and put it on the counter and let it bulk ferment, if you smell that after 2 or 3 hours, there's no chemical reactions taking place in that dough yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we tell folks that after 24 hours, and we show them a batch of flour that's been mixed after 24 hours, and we uncover it with the lid, and you can smell the carbon dioxide and the alcohol forming, right?
Yes, right.
It's amazing. But you can't, there's no shortcut for that.
Right.
Right? So that's what we teach in our classes, and then, you know, you use that, and then you take that on a 500 degree steel. I mean, it's literally mind blowing the pizza you can get.
Yeah, well, you of course you your recipes are wonderful for the pizza.
Oh, thank you.
And I wanted to say that not only do you deal with pizza, you deal with bread, and you deal with, I mean, the most amazing thing I thought was ice cream. You
right.
can freeze these things.
Right. So ice cream is funny because, well, we always steal stores energy, right?
Yeah.
And now we've got cold. What we do is we get some dry ice. We put the dry ice on a sheet tray, and we put the steel right on top. And literally 5 minutes later, you will have minus 30 degree steel.
Oh, no kidding. Wow, is that quick?
Yeah.
It's that fast. It's super fast.
Amazing.
And then you can, like, you take a creme anglaise or whatever your mixing pour on and just use your spatulas and roll it up.
Have a steel in order to be able to use hooks. Surely you must. People can buy, where can they buy them? Can they buy them at Amazon, probably? Right?
Yeah, they can buy them on Amazon. They can buy them on bakingsteel.com, which is our site.
Okay, great.
And we sell, you know, obviously all of them. We have some special packages with the steel because we have the book launching tomorrow, December 5th.
What? Oh, really? Another one?
Yeah, so the book's out tomorrow, and we're going to do like a steel and book package for the holiday season for folks if they haven't heard of us before and they want to, you know, pick up the steel and get these amazing recipes.
And that will be on the website?
Yes, it will. Yes, totally. Bakingsteel.com. Okay,
so,
that's fine. We'll still honor the steel package for the folks at the show. Do you want me to give you a code now? Would that be easier?
A code?
So they could use the code if they want a code for the...
Oh, sure, absolutely.
In fact, won't they just use... Was it on the menu?
Go ahead.
On the menu?
On the menu, and they'll get the package deal. It'll lead them to, like, you know, the special pricing.
This is when they're on bakingsteel.com?
Correct.
Great.
There's a promo code at the end.
Okay.
And it's called on the menu.
On the menu.
No punctuation.
No punctuation.
Well, I feel
like... Well, listen, listeners, I must tell you that there's more information in this book that you ever realized that you didn't know. I mean, it's like there's a recipe for making perfect bacon. I thought that was amazing. And you have your mixing ice cream thing. And
yes.
You have flatbreads. I really thought to make that Indian flatbread stuff, you had to use one of those clay ovens.
Right.
And you say you can do it on here. It's
totally.
Oh,
probably better because
the
temperature's probably even higher.
Yeah, it's hotter. It's evenly, the temperature's even on that steel, too. It gets scorching hot if you want it to.
Well, I'll tell you, you're my hot new resource here. I love all this stuff.
I love it.
Anyhow, okay, listeners, again, we're talking with Andrus Lagsden, and it's Baking with Steel, and you really need, this is an entryway into the future of food at this point, I think, Andrus, don't you?
Yes.
Great. Well, let's all get...
And it's an all-American success story.
Yeah.
It is.
Right there.
Yeah.
We're grateful every day, you know, that we're allowed to do things like this, and that's it. We're grateful that we're working every day and doing what we love.
Well, that's good. You said it was going to be a good example for your kids, and that's good.
It's a good lesson.
Yes.
It is.
And we'll be right back with another interview about baking with steel in a kind of a different way. Right?
No.
not in a different way? It seems to me like it's...
We're not baking with steel.
We're not baking with steel.
We're stir-frying.
We're frying with steel. That's a little different, I guess. Yeah. You're absolutely right. So anyway, don't go away because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com. .net.
Welcome back, and next up we still have talking about kitchen equipment, but we're also talking about how to use it, because both these guests, the previous one and the current one that we're just going to be talking to, whose name is Ching He Huang, who's from the UK, or is in the UK.
It sounds like he's from the UK originally,
well,
too.
No, she's Taiwanese. But at any rate, her book is called Stir Crazy, And you may have seen her if you ever spent any time in the UK on television, because she's very popular. She's a very popular television show. But again, like our previous guest, she devised and,
yeah,
and
she made
her own woke.
It's called a Lotus woke. And I'm not sure we ever found out why it was called a Lotus.
I don't know.
Anyway,
we may have to run out and get these two pieces of equipment.
It's a pretty good walk. I'm sure it's a pretty good walk. And this young lady sure knows how to use it. And she tells people about that all around the world.
And it's a combination of traditional and modern. So, it's really good timing for something like this. Remember, stir crazy. Well, Ching He Huang, you are such a star and such a constant in motion traveler. So maybe this title is great. Stir Crazy is your latest book. And it's one of how many books you've written?
It's the eighth one, unfortunately.
Why unfortunately?
Because I'm going stir crazy with it.
Oh, I see.
Well, that's a good name for it, right?
Yeah. Well, you really have done so much in terms of writing cookbooks, television, very popular television series, and you even invented a wok, right?
Yes, that's right. My Lotus wok. It looks like the surface of it works like a lotus leaf technology, in that it's got this kind of non-stick coating on it that helps you to have the best wok experience. So, if you want to wok like a wok master, you absolutely need to get one of these woks.
And how do you get that? Who sells them?
We sell them here in the UK, in London at the moment. And we're looking for partners for this product in the US.
I see.
Fingers crossed. Well, anyone listening out there.
You only need three places to go, and the first one is Amazon.com. You get on Amazon, you don't need to be anywhere else.
Yeah.
Actually, you're right. We should get on Amazon.co.uk here, and then we'll be on over there.
Exactly. Now, here's a question for you that you can sort of surround with an answer here, because for some reason, the British suddenly got really in love with really good Chinese cooking. Chinese cooking used to be terrible.
Yeah, I know.
When I was a child, you got a veg and three, and it was, when it was just terrible. And now there's been an uprise of excellent Chinese restaurants, and obviously they must have a lot. So why did you help spur that, or what happened?
Okay, so, well, you know, we had good restaurants in London,
yes,
in the UK, and some that are good in Manchester, but that's about it. And,
oh, we interviewed those sisters in Manchester, right? Is it sisters?
Yes.
Twins?
Yes.
Are they twins?
Also the C sisters. Yes. They are twins, absolutely. And they also had an amazing success. And, you know, I think we've got the best Chinese food sort of in Europe. Anyway, we had in terms of quality, but I think we've just gone up a level now, and we've got restaurateurs like Alan Yao that came on the scene and changed the game for everybody. So we had, you know, things like Ling Dim Sum, you know, at Yao Acha and Hakkasan.
Oh, Hakkasan,
yeah. That's really set the bar quite high. And now there's a lot of, you know, investors, travelers, you know, from China, and their palates are different. And so we've had to cater for their tastes. So I think it's gone from a more Cantonese-style cuisine to reflect more the different regional cuisines in China. Now, personally, you know, I'd like to think, you know, I've had something to do with it too, with my shows. But we also have, you know, people like Ken Hom, who has been around in TV terms, you know, for 30 years, trying to teach people about Chinese cooking. And so, you know, there's many, many more players now in the game. And I'm one of them. And, you know, I like to think that I've helped shape things differently for everybody. I mean, I know that I'm responsible for getting Shaoxing rice wine available in the supermarkets here. So it's just the one credit I have. I'll take that one.
Now we love a restaurant in Mayfair called Kai.
Oh, Kai, yes. Bernard Kai.
Which is wonderful. And the last time we went there, it was really curious. He was experimenting with a new thing for his kitchen. He gave them absolutely top of the line, fine lamb and other meats and said, cook with these. They had never had meat like that before. The meat was always something you had to hide away, and you had to flavor it up because it was really, really pretty terrible. And he said, "Why don't we try something different?"
Yeah, I think chefs have become more creative, and I know the chef there, Alex, is incredible, and Bernard, who owns Kai, they're doing some amazing stuff, and it is changed. I think people are more inventive. People are embracing, the freshest produce that they can get. And also China itself has come out of this bubble. And really, in terms of, they love, incredible food. And so their palates have become more and more luxurious, wanting to seek out the very, very best. I mean, remember, this was the bourgeois sort of Chinese, this is before, Mao Zedong and before communism, where there was a big demand for luxury and where eating was considered, real pleasure, as well as health too. But there is that sort of side to the culture. And I think now that people have more disposable income now in China, they want to experience all that best. And also they want to show off what they know best. So, I think it's a very exciting time for Chinese cuisine around the world and for the diaspora, because it really shows, what the community can do, and, there's new blood coming in and shaking things up. And, long may it continue.
Now, you of course, you're emphasizing one technique, which is stir frying in your book, which is why it's called Stir Crazy. But you also emphasize the health benefits of this type of cooking.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in terms of Chinese cuisine, when you go to China, we love to eat out, and we would go to a specialist restaurant that will do our rotisserie, like the roast ducks and et cetera, because we wouldn't necessarily have a wood-fired oven at home and all the skills to prepare that. And at home, the food is much more simple. It's much more, comforting, but also with a real emphasis on nourishment and health. And, in terms of what I do, I see myself as in the middle, trying to help our Western friends, appreciate good, healthy Chinese home cooking, and to see that Chinese cooking has a place in a Western kitchen environment, in a home environment. And it gives lots of benefits, you see, because it's quick, stir frying, like sauteing is quick, it's easy, you need a little bit of oil, you can see exactly what's going into it, and it tastes delicious. And there's hundreds of recipes that you could create, and you could also make your own sauces. So I wanted people to really fall in love with, stir crazy and stir frying and getting the most of eating seasonally and freshly, but also without too much expense. Because of course, we all love to eat out, but it's just not, sustainable every day, is it?
It's really funny. I'm thinking of a time when we were in San Francisco, and it was around 5 o'clock. And for some reason, at 5 o'clock in San Francisco, we were in Chinatown. And all of a sudden, all the Mrs. Chinese persons were buying their Peking duck and getting a spoonful of sauce to go along with it.
You have to get there quick, otherwise you don't get it.
That was it exactly. I thought, what would happen if they ran out before you got any?
Now, Ching, you have these little icons throughout your book. Can you explain them?
The icons, yes. Yeah. Now, in the book, I have a chopping board icon, which it tells you how long it takes to prepare the dish. And then I also have a little pot icon, which is supposed to be the wok.
I see.
And that's timing, lets you know how long it takes to cook in the wok. And then I also include some macro nutritional information, which is your, you know, energy, calories, carbs, and fat, etc. And it was a debate, you know, with my publisher whether I should put that information or not. But, you know, I wanted to demonstrate that if I'm saying that my recipes are healthy, I've got to prove that it's healthy. So I felt like a need to put that in there for those who are sort of conscious about what they're eating. And, yeah, and want to know how much of energy and sodium and all that that's going into the recipes. I feel it's my responsibility as a chef and as a cook to also provide that information and to make things as healthy as possible, but delicious. Because, you see, not everyone thinks healthy equals delicious. But in this case, it can be, I think.
I can see why your show is popular, because you're very lively.
I'm still picturing you with Rachel Ray. I'm wondering how you got a word in edgeways.
Oh, no, she's amazing. She's the queen of TV cooking.
You bet she is.
Yeah. So, now, you have a show that jumps. You move from San Francisco, no, Los Angeles, to London and to China, right? And to, yeah.
Yes. So I did a show in London, and then it brought me to New York, and then that brought me to L.A., and then that brought me to China, and then it's brought me back to London again. So I've been very lucky to work in a lot of places around the world, and also sample the Chinese cuisine in those countries as well, and to learn from chefs. I didn't grow up thinking I'd be a chef. I mean, I grew up on a farm in southern Taiwan. You know, I think that's where all my inspiration came from, was my grandmother and her cooking. And, you know, when I grew up and I lived away from Taiwan, all I wanted to be was, you know, like everybody else. And, chance had it that, you know, I ended up being in the food catering business and then being picked up on TV and books. And so I'm very blessed in that way. And also, I've learned a lot more about my culture and my cuisine, and I'm learning more and more every day. But you know, the food that we have is just so incredible now, you know, compared to what we had, you know, 10 years ago, and it's just a very exciting time because cultures are mixing. There's a lot of fusion inspiration. So, yeah, it's you know, it's because of technology and social media. Things are moving so fast that actually the creative food space is becoming more and more exciting.
If you can stand the time of the journey, you really should go to Chinatown in Melbourne, Australia.
Oh, that is the one place I've got to get to. It's on my list.
There's just some amazing Chinese food being made there, especially modern, what they call modern Chinese.
Yeah, we were there in March.
Yeah, if you decide to go, and you can remember, drop us a line and I'll give you a contact in Melbourne.
Oh, that would be brilliant. Oh, yeah. That would be brilliant. I'll give you my details you know, after the interview as well. So you've got my personal details as well.
Great.
We can share tips. Yeah.
I wanted to say, by the way, that sometimes when I used to pick up Chinese cookbooks, all the recipes called for the same three or four ingredients, and they all tasted pretty much the same. Your book
yes,
is very
is.
Different. Yeah, I don't know why. It was dry sherry and soy sauce and I don't know what, garlic, I guess. But anyhow, you have 100 healthy, you say, deliciously healthy stir-fry recipes, and they're very creative. They're not just like out of a textbook on Chinese food. So, I mean, I don't know where this recipe came from, but it sure is interesting. Sweet and sour baby squid with chili and kumquats.
Oh, yes. Oh, this I wanted to make really, you know, fresh and zesty, and I had the idea of using, you know, squid and kumquat. These two ingredients were my grandmother's favorite, actually. We had orangery and also kumquat. growing lots of kumquat plants and limes and fresh herbs and and peppers in our garden. And
when we were in Australia, Anne used to pick the kumquats off the tree and eat them.
Oh, they're so good, and they're so good for you too. Actually, they're really good for a cough. So you should definitely try and grab some.
I wish we had a tree.
And then here's another one that caught my attention. Lobster tails, baby asparagus, and eggs in hot bean sauce. And that's a family recipe too?
Oh, that's a family favorite. Actually, a lot of them, it wasn't originally used with lobster because growing up we didn't have the luxury of lobster. My grandmother would do is that she would use, and also asparagus wasn't native to where we are from. But what she would do, she'd use broccoli stems, like tender broccoli stems, instead of the asparagus. And instead of the lobster, she would use shrimp. So we'd have lots of baby river shrimp. Uh-huh. From the local river, and that's what we would have. They're very simple ingredients that worked really well together.
Well, I encourage everybody to pick up this book called Stir Crazy by Ching Yi Huang, because it's creative, it's healthy, and it's easy to use, isn't it, Ching? Huh? So and you lay everything out very straightforwardly. And I think that people will be able to take it to all kinds of different meals for their families.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I do hope that you people will give the book a walk and have a go.
A walk.
And stay crazy.
Thanks for talking to us, Ching. I know you're busy.
Thank you so much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, so we have a discontinuity between cooking utensils and metal. And something else we all love.
We have a little technology
chocolate.
Involved with
oh, we
this
do? Okay.
Because
right.
This guy does 3D printing.
Oh, right.
Yes.
He does 3D printing with chocolate, though.
Yes.
And he makes chocolate anyway.
Yeah, and he's worked out of the U.S., but he's born in Belgium, and his chocolates are Belgian-style chocolates.
And they are delicious.
I ate them all.
Them the day they arrived and didn't even get the one.
Yeah.
So there.
Choco Diem.
Choco Diem it is.
Jean-Paul Hepp, I'm talking to.
Yeah.
There's so many questions I have about your company. There's so many interesting quirks and twists. Choco Diem is the name of the company. And it,
correct.
In fact, is a play on words. Tell us about that.
Correct. Yes, so Choco Diem is kind of, the thinking was Carpe Diem, which means, of course, seize the moment.
Seize the moment.
But also Choco Diem is like one chocolate a day. So it's kind of play on words on that level. And I did that mainly because all the .coms, chocolatewhatever.com, was taken already. So I had to be kind of creative. And that was what came out. And it's working pretty well.
Yeah. Tell us, if you are Belgian, and the tradition from where are you from? Antwerp, yes.
I'm from Antwerp, yeah.
Yes. Anyhow, but the story I got was that you were unable to find Belgian-style chocolates in the U.S.
Yeah.
So my first question is, what exactly constitutes a Belgian-style chocolate?
All right. So you are right. In the 20 years I've been here, I couldn't find any good chocolate. Contrary to all the good beers that the Belgians have, we can easily find it here. But chocolate was a disaster.
Yeah.
So I worked for the pharma, and so I didn't have the time to do my hobby, which is the making of the chocolate. So one day I decided, with my daughter who is in Belgium, she made the recipes for me, and she sent it to me, and I adapted it to the American palate a little bit. So meaning, it's very sweet here. It's very sweet here. So it's very sweet. So what I try to do is to have the chocolate coming more out instead of the sugar coming more out. So the Belgian, what is Belgian chocolate? That's the right question.
Yes.
Neumann, if you have ever heard of him, if you've been to the airport in Belgium, you can by Neumann Chocolates. He was the inventor of what we call the Belgian truffles, Belgian pralines, which is a shell in whatever shape. The truffle is round. Pralines are different shapes, can be a cube or a twist or whatever. And then you fill it with a very good Belgian recipe. And then you cap it off and you sell it as is. That was the invention of Neumann in the end of the 1800s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then his wife invented, or created rather, the ballotine, which is the box that goes with this wonderful truffle. So, if you go into a store and you see a bar of chocolate saying that it is Belgian style chocolate, that does not exist. Because bars are not what the Belgian, what makes the Belgian chocolate so high quality. It's the recipe that we use to put inside of the shell. You have been in Belgium, so you know that we have a very good, it's like the French cuisine, but lighter. We don't use too much of this flour and fat and butter, which is very good, but we don't do that. We live basically next to, everyone lives on a farm or next to a farm, so we get everything fresh and local. That's what makes our Belgian chocolate Belgian chocolate. And the secret for me is not so much the shell or the chocolate I use, but the recipe that goes with the chocolate to make it a perfect combination and a recipe like we are used in our restaurants. Belgium has the highest density of Michelin stars. We were just talking about. That's like a Zagat rated restaurant system, but it's done by professionals. So you cannot go wrong in Belgium by choosing any restaurant. Most of the time it will be good food. So that's what we have for our Belgian chocolates now too, the pralines. That's what I couldn't find here. It's always very sweet, and the chocolate is barely something that contains sugar, and that's not working for me. I've been spoiled for more than 40 years in Belgium with good chocolate, and I missed that. That's hence I started my own company 5 years ago.
Now, interestingly, we talk to quite a lot of specialist chocolatiers here in this country with names like Eskenazi and what are some others of?
Yeah, Stauffenberg.
What they emphasize in conversation with us is that what's important to them is the quality of the source cacao.
Yep.
So they're constantly in search of new places where there are interesting versions.
Yep.
Of Kraft chocolate. Now, you're saying, are you saying that that's really, you don't agree with that approach?
Oh, yeah, I do. But that's, you know, my favorite chocolate comes from Ecuador. So you need to have a good chocolate. But I'm not going to say that's a Belgian chocolate. I'm not even using Belgian chocolate, what they call Belgian chocolate.
Okay.
So, yes, that's a pre-requirement. I even don't think about that anymore because it has to be the good chocolate from terroirs. They call it terroirs, like the wine. Terroirs, it has to be. That's the founding thing. But then the recipes that you make with it, that's the next step that has never, I mean, probably it does exist, but that's not being done on a recurrent level. And that's what I'm jumping in. You do have good chocolate bars, absolutely. Single source bars, fair trade. And I went to Ecuador and I saw this family run plantations and they do a very good job. It's excellent chocolate. But that's a base, that's an ingredient. Like we use less and less processed sugars and instead honey from local bees. So, you know, that's also an ingredient, but all the ingredients together have to make a perfect praline. That's what we are aiming for.
Now, tell us about this 3D printing. When did you start with that?
glad you asked. So this seems to be the first one in the area, maybe even East Coast, and maybe likely even on a domestic level. This is the 3D printer that is using good chocolate, high-quality chocolate, contrary to other printers like making cakes that use waxy chocolate. There is a difference between a good chocolate and a waxy one that the big producers use in general. The waxy chocolate, they extract the cacao butter out of the cacao beans, and that's the good stuff that they extract, and they sell it to cosmetic companies for skincare, and they replace it with the oils, palm oil, whatever. This has the advantage for longer shelf life and easy processing, certainly when you have an automated system. It's waxy and oil is better for the machines. Cacao butter, on the other hand, if you don't change anything for the cacao bean, is very difficult to work with because it has to be processed in a certain way to make it work. So the printer that I'm using, which is the 3D printer, is unique in that part that it does use gourmet high-end chocolates only. You have to what's called temper it, meaning that you have to play with the temperature to get the end product right, meaning the sheen, meaning the, even you can hear a good chocolate when you, it cracks like a browns, like a dead browns. The waxy chocolates don't have that. So we have that machine, and with a software company manager, I'm working together to scan any object, even humans or babies or whatever, and we can print it out in 2D or 3D. It's still in its infancy. It's like the first cars. They were kind of, looks okay, but it explodes once in a while. Now, this is not there yet, but it's the first of its kind. It's going to evolve in something very sophisticated in the future.
Now, you're using the 3D printer then to create a shape, a particular shape?
Also, or name, yeah, anything. Names, say, logos. We have done logos for companies. That's how we work. Or we can make molds, too. So you use that same scanning technique of that software company 3D Reactions, and he can make a food-safe mold out of it, and I can reproduce it. What I did with him is one of the statues in eastern Pennsylvania is the Bugler, which has to do with independence, and I do not know my history too well, but we put that in a mold and we can reproduce that many at once.
How big a company is this?
How big a company? Chocodiem or?
Yeah, Chocodiem.
Chocodiem? We started 5 years ago. The first year I was on my own with my daughter giving recipes and testing it in Belgium. And then gradually we grow. In the fourth year, we won the prestigious Top 10 Chocolatier Award of North America. And then now we have 2 stores. Next year, we'll have a 3rd store in Philadelphia, in the old city. And we have 7 to 8 full-time employees now.
Oh, so it's still a small production, huh?
So that's great.
It's still small, and we want to keep it like that. That's also the idea. Whenever we grow, whenever we go to another spot or city, we want it to be fresh, local, using the community around us, and even artists. We do paint artisanally our truffles and bars.
They're beautiful. They're really lovely. Yes.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
I ate them all the day they arrived.
Yeah, he did. I didn't. I mean, I'm telling you, I never had one of them.
She didn't get one. She doesn't like sweets anyway. So that's my excuse. Now, how do people who are not in Philadelphia or wherever the stores, how do they get some?
In Philadelphia, we do ship all over the country when it's cold like now. Right temperature, or we do overnight, but that's more expensive, so we do ship, no problem.
And the website where people can order is
chocodiem.com, http and then etc. www.chocodiem.com,
and people can order right off the website.
Yeah correct, sir.
Great.
Well, we wish you and
thank you
and your daughter a very happy holiday, and we wish
you
continued success with Chocodiem. Okay. It's a catchy name and a great idea.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
I'm expecting great things from this 3D printing when they get it all worked out.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Sean.
Have a good one. Happy holidays.
Bye-bye. Bye.
If you're a regular listener on the menu, you probably know by now that we're a sucker for a good story, and especially a good story about wine.
Yes.
So when we got an email all about a wine collaborative between a guy in South Carolina and a guy in California whose name just happened to be Gustavo, so you can tell he's not exactly from there to begin with.
Well, his last name is Gonzalez.
even more unlikely, but we discovered the root of the story is there were these two guys sitting at a bar, and they got onto the subject of wine, and listen,
and it resulted in a company.
Listen to the rest of the story. Gustavo, welcome to On the Menu Radio. You're talking to us from California, where it's at, where outside it sounds like it's a little windy, but at least there's no snow on the ground, which is what we have for our trouble just at this time of the year.
Now for our listeners, we're talking to Gustavo Gonzalez, who is the winemaker for Mira Wines.
And it's a bit of a story, but it's worth listening to. So the story goes, there was this man in a bar, and he started talking to another man in a bar about all things
in D.C., no less,
in Washington D.C. in the elegant Hay Adams Hotel. And somehow, after discussing a wide variety of other things, the conversation turned to wine, and perhaps you can explain why.
Well, I was sitting there after doing some wine events in D.C. at the Hay Adams, and talking to the bartender, just talking about the golden ratio, because I've always liked art and music and science, of course, too, and its prevalence in nature and the Fibonacci sequence and things like that. And a couple of seats over was another gentleman who was working in D.C. in public affairs, whose name is Bear, who kind of overheard the conversation and had some interest in it. It turned out that he was a big wine aficionado. And then we started talking, about making our own wine at some point, and what would our wine look like, and what kind of wines would we make. And then a few years later, we kept in touch, of course, and a few years later we had the opportunity to actually execute on what we had discussed at the bar several years beforehand.
So
and
you
that's kind of where we, what led to this.
So you were already a winemaker.
I was already a winemaker, yeah. I'd been making wine since 95, so at that time I was the winemaker at the Rondavi Winery in Napa.
Okay, there you go. That's a good place.
Yeah, I was responsible for all the red wines there for a while.
Okay, we know a number of the members of the Mondavi family. They like fighting each other, didn't they? kind of an unfortunate aficionado for punching each other out.
Right.
Well, we won't go any further than that.
Right.
So the venture got off the ground in when, roughly like about 2009?
Yeah, so our first vintage was 2009, and the way that it got off the ground is that, through my relationships at the Robert Mondavi Winery, I'd worked with some of the best, fantastic growers in the Napa Valley, and it just happened that 2009, one of those growers, Larry Hyde, and his famous Hyde Vineyard, had some Syrah available, and as luck would have it, that's one of Bear's favorite varietals, is Syrah, so we decided, Larry Hyde offered it to me, asked me if I could use it anywhere, and I said, well, I can probably use it if I wanted to start making my own brand, if you would let us, and he agreed to it, and here we are now, several years later, with not only Syrah, but several other varietals.
It sounds so casual.
That's kind of how it happened, it's like, you have that thought in your head, and then when the right opportunity comes, some people call that luck, but, you got to be ready for when the opportunity comes your way to take advantage of it.
Well, now, let's make sure that listeners understand the model that has been your model up until now, which is that you bought fruit from specialized grape growers, but non-winemakers in the Napa Valley region, and that was how you made your wine.
Yeah, that's correct. Most of the people that grow grapes don't necessarily make their own wine in Napa or in a lot of places. They specialize in growing grapes and then they sell them to different wineries. And that's been our model so far and up until last year when we bought a property in Yountville. But, we'll continue to buy grapes just like most people do. And it's one excellent way to secure that you always have really good fruit to make your wine because, as we know, the great wine comes from great grapes.
Now, is it, as you say, really all natural wine?
We're all natural. Yeah, we're minimally invasive in the techniques that we use to make the wine. So, we don't add. We use just your traditional ingredients. The fermentations are executed through yeast and the bacteria to do the malolactic fermentation, and then French oak for aging, and pretty much that's it.
But not any of this biodynamic nonsense.
No, I mean our growers are sustainable growers, and I think it's a much more interesting way to approach grape growing and agriculture than to be so dogmatic as biodynamic. I mean, there's definitely great things about biodynamic and organic, but I think sustainable kind of encompasses or embraces a lot of those things and just allows us to kind of go with the flow of what nature gives you any given season because, every season is different and you can't always and shouldn't always be doing the same things year after year just on a schedule. Nature doesn't necessarily always work on a schedule.
Now, yeah, well, you've had your challenges this year in California.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that next, because we're on the subject of Napa Valley, and you can't avoid thinking about the tragic fires that have happened. How much has that impacted you?
We were fortunate that we had finished harvesting right around the time that the fires began. So none of the vineyards that we work with or the grapes that we work with were impacted. Everything was already in the winery. So the big concern that we had was just because there was smoke in the air that we were going to maybe get some of the smoke quality into the wine. But we took some measures to make sure that we didn't expose the fermenting must to air or to the environment all that much, so that we could try to minimize or reduce the contact it had with any kind of smoke that might be in the air. But we were pretty lucky that we were pretty much finished by the time all that started. So
okay, now did that actually harm the vines themselves? Though, I mean, they have to come back next year and try to do the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, luckily for us, the people we work with, none of the vines were impacted. Aside from having smoke in the air, there were no fires, like, basically, or none of the vineyards that we work with caught on fire. So I think we're going to be in pretty good shape for next year.
Good.
Great. Well, we had the opportunity to sample one of your newest entrants into your wines, which is a really exquisite Merlot.
Thank you.
And but this is a new style for you, right?
Yeah, you know, we've kind of held back on making a Merlot. We've been working with Merlot from the Hyde Vineyard since, I think it was 2012 was our first vintage with them, with Merlot. And we've just always used it to blend. And then suddenly 13 and 14, you know, just learning how to work with the grapes in the cellar, we started changing or understanding a little bit more of the profile. Because it's a much cooler area down in the south of Napa, maybe. Could be considered not as suited for Bordeaux varietals, so it takes a little bit longer to ripen. But then we just started noticing that the 13 and 14 vintages of this Merlot were just outstanding. And we just started thinking it might be a good idea to bottle some of this up on its own because it's so good. And so in 14, we planned ahead of time that we really wanted to make a Merlot bottling that year. And so directly from the vineyards and into the winemaking, you know, we came out with the idea that it was going to be its own wine. And so it's made this wine that's it's got, you know, these fruit characters, but it's also got this kind of schist, rock, stone character to it, this mineral that's really interesting that I really don't find in too many Merlots in California.
Well, I was going to give you a yardstick to help our listeners to understand what it is you're describing if they're not into so many winemaker words. And when we think of Merlot in California, we think of Duckhorn. So if I was saying, well, it's sort of like Duckhorn, but it's not, or whatever, however you might describe that kind of comparison, how would you do that?
Well, I think ours tends to have a little bit more concentration and length.
Okay.
And there's just a little bit more to it, I think. I mean, the vineyard doesn't produce that much fruit, and we only make like 300 cases of this wine. So the fruit that comes out of there is just a little bit more concentrated. It might be just a little bit bigger than Duckhorn, let's say, from a density point of view, from a volume in your mouth point of view.
No, I was thinking of substantial as a word to describe it.
See? Yeah.
You can borrow that if you like.
Yeah, okay. Substantial for me.
Now, what will change with grapes coming from your newly owned land?
So we planted, there was already Chardonnay and Merlot growing there, and we pulled all that because it was virus, and we're planting... primarily, we're planting Merlot again, Cabernet Franc and Petit Verdot, which I think are sensational blenders, and they do well in that part of the valley, because the new property is basically in Yountville, and just that area there, I think these varietals that don't take as long to ripen as Cabernet are going to do really well there. So I'm curious to see what the profile of those three vineyards are going to be once we get the fruit going. Probably in 2020 will be the first vintage of that.
Well, you must make sure when 2020 comes along we get some to try, since we're here.
First.
So we're here sort of right at the beginning.
Certainly.
It's really, Gustavo, it's really a fascinating story, and Bear is a big part of it. So say hello to Bear next time you talk to him from Ann and
For
Peter,
sure.
And we thank you. very much for joining us today, and we hope you'll have a great day and a successful growing season next year, too.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, listeners, so we're so glad you joined us today. We hope you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.